Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to be joined by David Dayen, the executive editor of the American Prospect, to talk about one of the most important dynamics going on in this country right now. It's been called the Great Resignation by some people. David calls it the Great Escape. The mainstream press calls it a labor shortage. The country singer Johnny Paycheck called it take this job and shove it. Whatever you call it, people are quitting their jobs. Workers are striking at an almost unprecedented pace. Some people are abandoning careers and starting their own businesses. And regular listeners know that I'm going through this myself. I have not written a piece since February. I've been doing the show and keeping my toes in and trying to figure out what's next. Maybe writing will be it, but I don't know. I'm in this place where I'm looking to make a change, and it's all being kind of fueled by the trauma of the pandemic. We're going to devote the whole show to discussing this with David, in part because it's a rare positive story in a way. Like it's how we got here to where all of these people, millions of people, are so fed up that they're rethinking their whole lives is not a positive story. But the fact that you're seeing a kind of social change where people are like expecting more, expecting to be treated with human dignity, even in low wage jobs, that is a positive story. That is a positive effect of this otherwise extremely traumatic period in our history. But first, as you may know, a number of Republican governors have been sending National Guard troops, and in some cases, state police, perhaps health inspectors, I'm not sure, to the border between the U.S. and Mexico as part of the right's propaganda campaign against the Biden administration. I don't know how to say it otherwise. Let's be clear, right? Some 4,000 National Guardsmen and women from 20 states have been camped out at the border for much of this year. Highway patrolmen from Ohio, Nebraska, Florida, and Texas have also been camped out at the border. Texas has both state police and National Guard troops camped out at the border. And of course, they have nothing to do, right? Our southern border, as anyone who has visited the border area knows, is heavily, heavily militarized. There's plenty of border patrol agents down there. The number of border patrol agents on the southern border has increased by something like 18-fold over the past 25 or so years, right? Both Republican and Democratic administrations, for different political reasons, have sent just masses of troops down there. And anywhere near the border, you feel them, right? If you can drive, as I have several times, you can drive on, I think it's I-10. You're maybe 50 miles from the border. You drive through Texas, you will be stopped at a Border Patrol checkpoint. Even if you're, again, 50 miles from the border, 30 miles from the border, whatever it is, they have checkpoints. And much of the current flow of migrants from Mexico are, in fact, asylum seekers, right? And seeking asylum is legal. A lot of those people turn themselves in. They're not trying to evade border patrolmen. They're trying to turn themselves in and apply for asylum. And what's going on is not the result of some weakness at the border. It really has nothing to do with the border itself. We have, you know, these increased flows because of continuing violence that has plagued Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua for several years now. Part of it is that, you know, we were shut down during COVID, so there's like pent up demand. So there's like there's all of the reasons for immigration have nothing to do with the border itself. So we have these National Guard troops that Republicans are spending tens of millions of dollars to keep there to serve as political props. And they are, in fact, legally restricted in what they can do. They can't go and be cowboys and stop illegal immigrants. They can't even do that stuff. They are there to observe. And in limited circumstances, they can lend like backup support to the border patrols. They have nothing to do. They have nothing to do. And let's be clear that only two of the 20 states that have sent these poor servicemen and women to hang around doing nothing for Fox News and for this right-wing narrative about chaos at the border, only two of those 20 states are border states, right? I mean, you have people who you have states that border Canada that are sending National Guardsmen to the Mexican border. It's insane. Now, and you can, this makes sense, right? If your goal is not to do anything, but it's just to give Fox News fodder, then you don't need to equip those troops. So they are poorly equipped. According to an in-depth report by David Winkie for the Army Times, commanders had, quote, left soldiers at isolated observation posts for hours on end without the night vision goggles they needed. They stared into the darkness and fell asleep on the job, end quote. And that is the least of the problems that have plagued this prop army. According to that same report, again, this is by the Army Times, from the Army Times, by a reporter named David Winkie. By the way, the Army Times, the Military Times, they actually do pretty good coverage. They're not like mouthpieces for the military command. They've uncovered some pretty important stories within the military. According to this piece in the Army Times, and I quote, when troops weren't on duty, most were at hotels in remote locations. Alcohol and drug abuse became so widespread that senior leaders issued breathalyzers and instituted alcohol restrictions that tightened as the misconduct incidents piled up. At least 16 soldiers from the mission were arrested or confined for charges including drugs, sexual assault, and manslaughter. And to put this into perspective, during that same period, only three soldiers in Kuwait were assigned for court-martial. So 16 soldiers, and there is a similar similarly remote deployment, but in Kuwait, there are more soldiers. So in Kuwait, where there are more soldiers in the middle of nowhere, three soldiers were court-martialed. Here it was 16. Commanders and I guess local authorities, although it's a little unclear from the piece, initiated more than 1,200 legal actions against these board troops. So this included, minor legal actions, fines or whatever. That's nearly one legal action for every three soldiers. Here again, I'm going to quote, troops at the border had more than three times as many car accidents over the past year than the 147 illegal substance seizures that they reported assisting. They had 500 car accidents, and they assisted in seizing drugs 147 times. It's pathetic, right? I mean, again, quoting from the piece, one cavalry troop from Louisiana was temporarily disbanded due to misconduct and command climate issues, an extremely rare occurrence. I would like to know more about this story because I bet this is a really interesting story, but this is all we get in this piece. Plus, a 1,000 soldier baton level task force based in McAllen, Texas had three soldiers die during the border deployment. For comparison, only three Army Guard troops died on overseas deployments in 2021 out of tens of thousands. So one staff officer who served on the mission told the Army Times, and I quote, we are literally the biggest threat to ourselves down here. And I have to say that it bothers me a lot that this isn't a bigger story. Why am I reading about this in the Army Times? Trump did the same thing during the lead up to the 2018 midterms. He stationed a bunch of troops at the border for photo ops, and he kept them there during Thanksgiving, right? Doing nothing. And this is the party that claims to support the troops. And I also have to ask you to just imagine for a second if the left, broadly speaking, the broad left had its own Fox News. What a big story this would be. What a giant story this would be. All of these troops separated from their families, doing nothing at the border just for propaganda purposes. Just for for nothing else. It's outrageous. Anyway, these troops can't tell their governors that they're quitting, but lots of Americans can and do, and we're going to talk about it after a quick break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm really pleased to welcome David Dayan to this week's show. David is the executive editor of the American Prospect. He has the cover story in the November-December print issue of the Prospect. It is a really rich and detailed look at what is behind a phenomenon that many have called the Great Resignation. David calls it the Great Escape. Whatever you call it, millions of Americans have quit their jobs and in many cases sought out entirely new careers during the pandemic. We've seen this with people up and down the wage scale. We've seen it among educated professionals, but it has been disproportionately the case with lower income workers who have been, you know, fed a shit sandwich, not only in terms of wages, but also in terms of human dignity, if you will, for a couple of decades, and they appear to be sick of it. David, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time. Let me set this up really quickly with some eye-popping numbers from your piece. And by the way, listeners need to go read David's piece because we can't do it justice here. It's really granular. In September, 4.4 million workers quit their job. It was a new record high. That was 3% of the workforce in 1 month. That was also the case in August. And over the long term, the average is less than 2%. So there's always some churn. You write that in low wage sectors like leisure, hospitality, food services, and the like, the numbers were as high as 6.6%, which is a stunning number. You cite surveys that find that a lot more than that are thinking about pulling the trigger. And in the piece, you say that every pundit has weighed in with an explanation or a potential explanation for this. What are the kind of conventional storylines that people are hearing about why this is happening?
Yeah, well, I should say that we actually just got new numbers today, and the October quit rate, I think some economists were overjoyed at the fact that it was down to 4.2 million people quitting their jobs in October.
As if 2.8%,
yeah, it was. As if this is, a cause for everyone to go home. There have been a ton of explanations, all of them which have their own sort of kernel of validity, I think, to them. Obviously, we're still in a pandemic and there are health and safety fears that people have. There's an inability for people to access affordable childcare services in particular. The workforce is down about 10% from pre-pandemic levels, and it was already the case that there were a lot of childcare deserts. So that's a part of the story. There have been a lot of people who retired early during the pandemic thinking, I've kind of had enough. Restrictions on immigration have caused a shrinking of the workforce itself. There are so many of these explanations, and all of them paint a little bit of the picture. But I don't think they get at the psychological reasons why we're seeing this relative to other instances where all of those things have been in evidence, right? I mean, it's not like this is the first time that we've seen restricted immigration, or that we've seen, we knew that we were going to have a demographic challenge with a lot of retirements because the baby boom generation was aging out. We've seen a lot of this stuff before. Why now? Why are so many people in record numbers leaving their jobs. Part of it obviously is that we have a tight labor market and people can find better opportunities elsewhere. But I really think that part of it is that people, through the collective trauma of the pandemic and the fact that work, especially in the low-wage sectors, was getting worse and worse, because you weren't only subjected to sort of ongoing misery, but you were risking your life in addition. I really think that weighed on people and gave them sort of this idea that they had to escape, even if it hurt them financially, even if it created uncertainty. They had enough with being disrespected through a very large part of their lives, which is their workday.
You know, I'm always amazed by how kind of widespread conservative or pro-business messaging is, how ubiquitous it is. And I was in a liquor store a few weeks ago, stocking up on booze, and there were a couple of women there who were obviously regulars. They knew the saleswoman, and you know, I wasn't sure. Maybe they got their news from Fox, or maybe they were busy with other stuff and don't pay a lot of attention to the news. But whatever it was, they knew that there was a labor shortage, and they were convinced that it was caused primarily by like lazy people getting welfare. You know, and it's, you hear this all the time. At the heart of your piece, you know, you kind of eschewed the punditry and spoke to a bunch of workers who actually quit their jobs, sometimes in dramatic fashion. It's anecdotal, of course, but tell us a little bit about some of the common themes that you bumped into talking to people who actually quit the labor force.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just first say that one thing that's not anecdotal is that we know that so-called welfare is not really a factor here. And we know it because we had this natural experiment over the summer. 25 states ended their enhanced unemployment benefits that were in the COVID relief packages early. They were and explicitly trying to get people back into the workplace by cutting off their means of financial support. And we have statistics. We can line up the states that cut off benefits early and the states that didn't. And there's essentially no difference in payroll growth among those two sets of states. It was not the case that people were driven back into the workplace. And my discussions with individuals kind of points to why.
Well, hold on. Let me just make one point here real quickly, because you're right. We shouldn't let that kind of talking point stand. There's another thing that we have that is hard data in terms of broader different comparisons between different countries with similar economies. We have in the United States one of the most kind of threadbare social safety nets in the developed world. And what people like economist Dean Baker have pointed out for a long time is that we don't have a higher labor participation rate among prime age workers than do other wealthy countries that have more expansive benefits. So the idea that public benefits causes all these indolent people to just sit around, first of all, you can't survive on, you know, temporary assistance for needy families and some supplemental food nutrition, you know, assistance and stuff like that. When you look at other countries, you compare other countries with wealthy countries, what you see is that more of our elderly may work. But that's an indictment of our whole system, if you ask me. Anyway, sorry about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so these stories that were told, both on a domestic level and international level, just don't add up. And Republican lawmakers increasingly try to find any way of forcing people back into the workplace. In Wisconsin and Ohio, they're trying to change child labor laws, letting 14-year-olds work as late as 11 p.m. There are advertisements for young teenagers to work in various businesses. There is, you know, this sense that I'd rather sort of roll back the gains in labor of the 20th century than actually pay people a decent wage and give them decent work conditions. And in my discussions with people, that's what's missing. And it's not so much the wages. It's the fact that they're being sort of forced into this unendurable sorrow. I mean, the emblematic kind of statement that I heard from someone as I talked to this woman named Caroline Potts, who was a dog groomer at a PetSmart in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Now, this is not a factory job circa the progressive era. This is not working at a meatpacking plant. This is not working at a foundry. This is not the kind of job that you think would create this kind of horror. But the way in which this business went about, where this woman who was really a pet lover was forced to kind of by circumstance injure, frighten, and really harm animals, brought her to this point where she said to me, you know, I would be driving to work and I would think about and daydream about getting into a car accident so I wouldn't have to get to my job. Think about what it would take to get you to be in that position. And what she said was, and when I told my colleagues about that, they said, yeah, that's how I feel too. And so we have created over the last several decades an entire sector of the workforce. And by the way, the low-wage sector in the U.S. workforce is about 1/4 of the total workforce, which is more than any other developed country. And we have created not just a penurious low-wage workforce, but a really miserable one with bad work conditions, constant harassment from superiors, forcing to get people to work faster and faster and increase their productivity more and more without getting any of the benefits of it. All of these things that we've known about for some time and they all got worse during the pandemic because it added this health and safety aspect to it. And I really think that there was a collective breaking point among the low-wage sector, and it came up in almost every conversation that I had.
You know, you talk about the role of private equity, the financialization of the American economy, which is, I should say, a topic you've written the book on, not just proverbially, but literally. Can you help us connect that trend with this one of treating people like crap? How are those things related?
Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned PetSmart. PetSmart is owned by a private equity firm. They're owned by a firm called BC Partners. And in fact, about 11.7 million U.S. workers, most of them low wage, now work for companies owned by private equity firms. And the entire private equity business model is that you load up these companies with a lot of debt and you try to extract the value out of them. And the only way for the companies to survive is to cut their labor costs or cut their, you know, regulatory compliance costs. In other words, the health and safety and of the workplace itself, which is sort of another cut to labor's kind of in an indirect way. And I talked to a lot of people who were involved in this. And I mean, another classic example of this was a woman who I talked to who worked for a Sonic. Sonic is another private equity owned firm. They made the tipped minimum wage, which is something you see in the restaurant industry a lot, where you're allowed to pay people well below the standard minimum wage in a particular state with the belief that tips from customers will make up the difference. And the problem is that the technology that was used at Sonic, which is kind of a drive-thin kind of situation where people go up to a carrel and they order at the drive-in and then it's brought out to them by these servers. Well, there was no way to give a tip on the driving carrel. And so these workers were working for $5 an hour with no way to supplement that. And it was done sort of by technological design, because having to change the technology would be a business expense that a private equity firm like Rourke Capital, which owns Sonic, would not want to invest in. So, and then you add on this layer of someone risking their life for $5 an hour, which is what this woman was making. The very structure of the private equity business model is immiserating to labor. And that's replicated in a lot of other places in the workforce, but it's most acute, I think, in that private equity area.
David, do you think that American businesses' kind of relentless, decades-long assault on organized labor and the minimum wage falling so far behind productivity growth, our lack of guaranteed, you know, medical leave and the like, have those things backfired as a result of the pandemic? I mean, do you think that there is an alternative scenario where, say, Congress raised the minimum wage since 2009 to whatever, 12 or 13 bucks an hour? We gave workers more, let's say, crumbs, right? Mm-hmm. Where we wouldn't see these so-called labor shortages that the business community is now whining about all the time.
I mean, I certainly think that's true to an extent. I think if you gave the business community two options, one with a stronger ability for people to organize their workplaces, which would give more stability, and the other where they wouldn't have to worry about organizing so much, but they would have this instability, I think they'd choose the instability every time, because it takes a lot. Even with what we're seeing right now, it's a kind of individualized phenomenon, right? You see one person quitting their job. It's not an entire workforce walking out, although you do see that in certain cases. I talked to a woman at a Jack in the Box in Sacramento, who's they were experiencing terrible conditions during a heat wave. The heat within the facility was something like over 100 degrees. And when they asked their manager about this, the manager first ignored it and second said that all the workers must have menopause because that's why they feel so warm. Absolutely. And so what happened is that entire workforce at a Jack in the Box, a non-union workplace, where the woman who I talked to was primarily a Spanish speaker, they all walked out. And they were successful in being able to win better protections, better pay, and actually getting that manager fired by doing so. But, you know, that's sort of anecdotal. And while we are seeing a lot of walkouts, sort of more organized walkouts like that in non-union workplaces, over 1,600, according to one study done by the website Payday Report. It's still, you know, we have a workforce of 150 million people, right? So I think the business leaders will take their chances that they won't be one of the few that will experience this. I think one thing that's so fascinating about the Great Resignation is how this individualized action, this personal action, has been collectivized in some way through both non-union workplaces organizing amongst themselves and also through the phenomenon of social media. So we're seeing things like the anti-work Reddit subreddit. We're seeing things like on TikTok, there's a quit my job hashtag. You're seeing people broadcast their resignation, sometimes in real time, like on Facebook Live. There was a famous, I talked to the woman, her name is Shayna Blackwell, who quit over the PA system at Walmart and videotaped it and then put it up on TikTok, and it got millions and millions of views. There's almost a collective consciousness around this that you wouldn't have been able to see maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, that is able now because of social media, where people are seeing others being courageous, and maybe it's influencing them to be courageous as well. Ultimately, I think it's going to take massive worker organizing in order to sustain this in a way that workers at the low wage end do get a better deal. But I would say this kind of change in collective consciousness is forcing the issue at a much more rapid rate than it would have otherwise been.
Yeah. Payday Report, by the way, is put together by Mike Elk. I was his first editor way back a long, long time ago. Folks, again, David's piece is really important. We've got more to cover here. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be right back with some more really interesting insights here. Stay tuned.
Attention Walmart shoppers and associates. My name is Beth from Electronics. I've been working at Walmart for almost 5 years, and I can say that everyone here is overworked and underpaid. The attendant policy is bullshit. We are treated from management and customers poorly every day. Whenever we have a problem with it, we're told that we're replaceable. I'm tired of the constant gaslighting. This company treats their elderly associates like shit. To Jared, our store manager, you're a pervert. Greta and Kathy, shame on y'all for treating your associates the way you do. I hope you don't speak to your families the way you speak to us. Shout out to Kamenik, Patty, Chardell, and so many more. Walmart doesn't deserve y'all. Fuck manage it and fuck this job. I quit.
We're back with David Dayan from the American Prospect to talk about his cover article. It's called The Great Escape. I urge you to read it. David, we had a guest on relatively early in the pandemic, and I feel terrible for this, but right now his name escapes me, and hopefully it'll come back to me in a moment. But he wrote a great piece arguing that pandemics have always caused great social upheaval, and we're really one of the few phenomena, along with civil wars, major technological changes that have led to significant and kind of rapid changes in how societies were structured. You wrote in the piece, and I quote, "If you call someone an essential worker for long enough, they start to believe it. They start to wonder whether they deserve more given their essential nature."
Yeah.
Which is so interesting. And really, that's, I thought that that sentence was kind of the heart of your piece, right? Like there's something there. Are there parallels that you see from the last century, the 20th century, one that was marked by world wars and major technological changes that you can see between that moment and this moment?
Yeah, there are actually a lot of parallels, and they go back throughout several centuries, actually. But we can start with looking at labor unrest in the 20th century, and there were two big years for it. And the first year was 1919, and the second year was 1946. And this happens to be right after World War I and right after World War II, when Americans came back from the European front and they were hailed as heroes that helped preserve democracy. And then they were put into jobs that were decidedly less than heroic and decided that they wanted more out of those jobs. And we're seeing a similar phenomenon right now. It is, I should say, happening among organized workforces as well. I mean, we've seen a lot of strikes and organized labor actions. But the fact is that the US workforce has about 6 to 7% union density. And the only way that you're really going to see these changes taking place is in the non-unionized workforce. And I think that's why that's been so strong. But this is not just particular to the last century, and it's not just particular to wars. In fact, a really interesting study that went back several centuries and looking at pandemics, 19 of them, stretching all the way back to probably the biggest one, which was the Black Death of the 14th century, where in the most affected areas, about half the population died. They looked at the economic consequences after pandemics, and they found, this is a working paper, it's from the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they found that real wages consistently went up after pandemics. The other interesting part of that was that the return on capital consistently went down. We're not seeing that right now. We're actually seeing record profits within the larger business community, which is why they're they're whining about the labor shortage when they have more than enough money to actually forestall that is pretty, you know, it should be ignored, let's say. Yeah. But this is pretty consistent that people after pandemics, workers after pandemics, suddenly find themselves in a more powerful position. And the Black Death was the most obvious example of this, because you just simply, you had a real labor shortage, not a rhetorical labor shortage, but you literally didn't have enough people to work the fields. And peasants and serfs who had absolutely no power before this time recognized that, and they started moving to other lords and trying to get a better deal for themselves. And the backlash was really interesting to this. The first labor law in England was the Ordinance of Laborers of 1349. And that not only stopped labor mobility, but it set a price control and a wage control in rural areas, restricting the ability for any serf or peasant to bargain for more pay. It also said that everyone under the age of 60 had to work and had to have a contract, in a bounded contract, to work for a particular lord. And if you found somebody that wasn't bound to work for somebody else, you could say, I compel you to work for me at this prevailing wage. So there were all of these laws put in place to force basically to preserve the power relationship that lords and the elites had over serfs. And the important thing to say about that is that while it was pretty hardcore and pretty brutal, it didn't work. Employers would inevitably have to pay more to get and retain a qualified workforce. Employers even though being forbidden from offering higher wages or cheaper rent or actual cash wages, which a lot of serfs didn't get, they were giving it to them anyway. And so there is this even the law wasn't able to stop this reckoning that people had over their own circumstances. And that's perhaps an interesting parallel to today.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating parallel. And I just want to hone in on that point that you just made. They were restricting, they're placing all these restrictions on labor. They made it illegal to beg.
Right.
But at the same time, they also instituted price controls to keep the landed gentry from extracting excessive profits, right, at the same time, which is missing from our...
That's what we don't have today, exactly. Where we see American businesses right now showing their biggest profits in 70 years,
yeah,
capitalizing on this undercurrent of inflation, which is real, but they're topping it off by not just passing on the input costs, and that includes labor, but it's not just restricted to labor. They're not just passing off those costs to customers. They're passing those off and then adding a little bit.
And then adding some.
And if you listen to earnings reports, you hear CFOs and CEOs ebullient that they're finally able to raise prices. They call it a once in a lifetime opportunity and things like that. So weep not for the poor companies that are allegedly experiencing a labor shortage.
And as much as you hear about inflation, real wages, that is wages adjusted for inflation, are increasing.
Well, certainly they are at the low wage level.
Low wage level, especially.
In the middle, there's kind of a dip. They're increasing at the high end and at the low end. And in the middle class, they're actually, they're below. Real wages are actually falling. And that, I think, is a political problem, I think,
yes,
for Democrats in a major way. But what I'm talking about in this piece is really about this sort of revolution at the low end of the scale. And there we're seeing wages rise as much as 12%, which is really remarkable. But I try to make clear in the piece that this is not just about wages. This is about giving people a voice on the job. The city of Houston became the first, or one of the first, to actually create an essential workers board, which gives those gives a group of workers who would participate in policy recommendations to local regulators over how workplaces should be governed. So workers are not just looking for a little bit more money. They're looking for they're looking for more fulfillment. They're looking for better conditions. They're looking to not be disrespected. And really what it comes down to is they're looking for more power. Yeah. And that can happen in the context of a workforce that takes their decisions and their ideas into account. And it also can manifest in another thing that we're seeing almost remarkably, which is an extreme increase in business formation. This is something we did not see after the Great Recession. The business formation was cratering after that at a tremendous low point, but it has skyrocketed during the last 12 to 18 months. People are saying, okay, I'm done with working for somebody, I'm going to work for myself. Now, we don't know how those are all going to turn out, and we know that a lot of businesses fail. Yes. But I think it's really significant, and we actually created the conditions with our pop-up safety net that we created, this ability for people to get by in the pandemic. We created the conditions for people to take those risks and maybe try to fail and decide for themselves the way in which they want to live their life, which is ultimately what this is sort of all about.
Interesting that progressive economists have long said that if you have a more generous safety net, you actually encourage people to take greater risk, to start their own businesses, you create a more dynamic economy, which is kind of contrary to the conventional wisdom, as if you will. And as David says, it's not just about wages. Amazon is now dangling free college tuition, as he writes, mm-hmm. As are Macy's, Walmart, Target. David notes that Tyson Foods has experimented with offering 40 hours of pay for 36 hours of work, so a little bit more flexibility. People have suffered a lot of unnecessary pain to get to this point, but I think overall, at least potentially, it's a feel-good story, a rare feel-good story in a very shitty time.
It is potentially, and I would add to that the organizing that we're seeing. There's a vote that we're going to start to hear about later this week at a Starbucks, a series of Starbucks in Buffalo. There's a Dollar General in Connecticut that's trying to go union. Obviously the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, which is getting a second go. And there are other warehouses that are looking into unionizing. I think you're not going to be able to sustain this without, even though it's sort of a social transformation, it has to be backed up by law, and it has to be backed up by collective action and collective bargaining and worker organizing. I had the pleasure of talking to Sarah Nelson, who's one of our great labor leaders. She's with the Association of Flight Attendants. And I thought her response to what labor should be doing in this moment was fascinating. She said, you know, we should look at businesses that should be striking for recognition. We should see more walkouts. We should see more people, taking on bosses and doing sit down strikes or things like sit down strikes that will lead to more organizations that will be able to organize workplaces. And ultimately, I think that's what we've seen historically, is that kind of labor militancy that has merged with this sort of social reckoning to create enduring benefits for workers. Otherwise, you have someone quit, they get a new job, and everything's fine until the next recession, when they either get laid off or they get their wages cut or they get their hours cut. So there has to be that anchor, that foundation, and it comes down to labor, the labor movement.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. David Dayan, I've been trying to find positive stories to talk about. It's been bleak. And I really want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk about something that is positive. The piece is called The Great Escape. Listeners can read it at prospect.org, not .com. David Dayan, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
All right, Jess, thank you very much.
I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Yo, 6 o'clock every morning, you waking up yawning to the sound of your alarm clock alarm. About an hour from now, you should be at your place of employment, which is annoying because it's so boring. Your co-workers be talking too loud for you to ignore them. It affects your occupational performance. You wonder why your workload is so enormous, because your boss just laid off 3/4 of the whole office. People get depressed, they get ulcers from the stress that the corporate environment causes. Regardless of how you ultimately want to solve this, seems to me like you got 1 in 4 choices. You could take a new job offer for more chips, stick it out a little longer or forfeit.